Truth Seekers, Mike Malloy here. We are we're going to open up the lines right away tonight. So if you want to comment on Mr. Obama's speech tonight, you can do so. 877-996-2556. The lines are open. 877-996-2556. Well, I watched the whole speech, and the main thing that impressed me was the fact that John Boehner was sitting there drunk. I can't help but be impressed by little trivial crap like that when the Republic is going into the garbage can. It shows the level of my consciousness. But anyway, there sat Boehner drunk on his ass, just unable to even show any response or emotion whatsoever. And every time the camera, of course, would pan into the Republican side of the House, it was really grim. The feeling was all those Republican senators and representatives were attending a funeral. And they probably are. It's a funeral for the United States. Even though Obama said over and over and over again, and I've got in front of me here, it's available, the American Jobs Act. You can find it online and download it from a PDF file. But I've got the whole thing here. I haven't had a chance to read through the entire thing. So without my weighing in on the pluses or minuses of what the details are of that he proposed tonight, that Obama proposed tonight, simply because I haven't read into it. I just listened and watched. It was still interesting to me to see the utter deadness of the Republican Party. And as Obama pointed out over and over and over again, what he was proposing are solutions, as he calls them, that have been put out there many times before, either on a bipartisan level or by Republicans. And, of course, the Republicans are not interested in any of this. They just aren't. So, watching Mr. Obama practically beg, literally, after a while, it got kind of difficult for me to continue to watch a 50-year-old man standing there begging a bunch of zombies to respond. Something, anything. Are you awake? Are you alive? Can you do anything? And, of course, there was no reaction. I've never seen a more corpse-like individual than Mitch McConnell a couple of times where the camera zeroed in on him. A dead turtle who's been in the sun 4 or 5 days after it died. It just, oh my God. I just know that so many of these Republicans who sat there, just they have the stench of death about them because they are very busy in the process of murdering America. And it just wasn't very, very pleasant to watch. Pleasant at all. So, again, without weighing in on the pluses or minuses of what Obama had to say, you have to admit it was an impassioned speech. Most of his are, but this one was especially so as far as I'm concerned. And it was a real plea, or as far as I was able to evaluate. And it was a plea. It was just, like I said, it was just almost begging for some kind of action on the part of these Republicans. And for that reason, it's dead on arrival. I don't think anything is going to happen whatsoever. I think I have another correction to make. Last night's program, I was talking about the cutting the military retirement and the proposed replacement of it with 401k. Michael and Roswell points out, you seem to suggest that this was all the work of Republicans. It's important to note that while the Republicans may be in favor of the proposal, it was the Democrats who first floated it publicly on August 16th. Leon Panetta made the announcement at the National Defense University on that date that the Pentagon has had the issue under study and that he approves. So, here's one more indication that the Democrats are completely tone deaf because they're the ones who are going to be blamed for this, not the Republicans. He said, Michael adds, there are a number of ramifications to this. It will probably have an immediate impact on reenlistments and a delayed impact on enlistments. But it's also going to have some very negative effects on present morale, and not all of them easily predictable. The ridiculous part of this is that the military retirement spending is about $10 billion a year these days, and the annual average annual savings over the next 20 years is anticipated to be about $12 billion. That's chump change for the Pentagon and a fly speck on the total national budget. Why on earth create such intense ill will in the military for so little in savings? It's both bizarre and perverse, and the simple political optics are terrible. Whatever the thinking behind it, was done by someone with his head up his ass. Michael in Roswell, New Mexico. I stand corrected. I meant to imply, because I had read the article also, I guess I left out the part about, I didn't know about Panetta floating it, but I knew that some Democrats were in favor of this, but I'm still locked into that Democrat-Republican thing, even though I've said so many times on this program that both parties are pretty much useless at this point because they're owned outright, with a couple of individual exceptions, but both parties are owned outright by corporate America. I still work from that 50s and 60s paradigm where Democrats were Democrats, Republicans were Republicans. And they could work some things out, other things could not be worked out. But I think both parties at the time, insofar as they were not controlled by capitalism back then, and I don't think they were to the extent that they are now, I'm talking 50 years ago now, truth seekers, to the extent that they were not controlled by corporate America, they still had the best interests of the entire country, I think, at heart. I think, with a few exceptions. Whereas the exceptions today are people who are truly interested in saving the country. The exceptions 40, 50 years ago were people who were truly interested in destroying the country. And now it's just flip-flopped. But I stand corrected on the Democrat-Republican thing. Nobody wants to call? Really? Okay. I thought y'all might have some comments about what Obama said. No? All right, I'll give the number again, though, 877-996-2556, if you do, if you change your mind. Starbucks CEO and former owner of the, is it Seattle Sonics, Howard Schultz, yesterday on his conversation with America Online, he said that... it took a lot of personal courage, his words, took a lot of personal courage to call for a boycott of political donations until federal politicians reduce the deficit and get to work in a bipartisan manner. Several days ago, I think, Schultz did this, or maybe it was last week, that there should be no political donations to any of these parties or candidates whatsoever until they get their heads out of their asses and start acting with the best interests of the country foremost in their actions. I think what Schultz doesn't understand is that's no longer possible. I appreciate where Schultz is coming from. He said that as someone who grew up in federally subsidized housing in New York City, he's from the projects. He was what he calls the beneficiary of the American dream. And he said he decided to try to starve politicians of their lifeblood, money, after watching that crazed debate over the nation's credit limit and attempts to deal with the federal deficit over the summer. More on this in a second. But I think while Schultz, I think, has the right attitude here, he doesn't understand that the corporations that own both political parties are not going to hold back their contributions. They're getting exactly what they want.
boom, boom, boom. Bang, 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 bang. I love the way you walk, and I love the way you talk. When you walk that walk, and you talk that
talk. The Mike Malloy Show. All substance, no abuse.
21 past the hour. Coming up, top of next hour, Margaret Flowers, Dr. Margaret Flowers is going to join us. You want to hear this interview coming up next hour. Howard Schultz, Starbucks CEO and former Seattle Sonics owner, said that America right now is sick. He says, I think it's very important that all of us recognize that leadership in Washington should not dictate to all of us a direction that we know in heart and soul is wrong, end quote. He said there was a direct linkage between the soaring federal deficit and the unbelievable pressure that is on the economy and high unemployment levels. Schultz said what's coming in America as a result of those state deficits, there's going to be significant cuts in state services. And the gap between the haves and the have-nots is going to get wider. More than 100 business leaders have put their names to Schultz's pledge not to give money to Senate and House incumbents until there's a genuine cooperation in Washington, D.C. to reduce the deficit. Well, good luck on that, Mr. Schultz. Once you get the Koch brothers to sign up, let me know. Okay? Tom is in Chicago, listening on Sirius. Hello, Tom.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm all right.
You know, good. listened to the president's speech last night, or tonight, and just kind of, you know, thinking about my own reality here mm-hmm. in Illinois. I work with a school district here in Illinois, and we're in a community that doesn't have a lot of money. So,
right.
You know, but we had to increase student achievement, and we knew we had to, and we looked at the data, and we knew we had to change some programs around. So what we did is just reapportion, you know, some of the money that we had
uh-huh.
to programs that we knew that were research-based and could really kind of get more bang for the buck kind of thing.
Right.
And so so that's my reality on a local level. And we saw some great achievement gaps. You know, for instance, we knew that early literacy mm. was key, and kids in our community were not coming ready to learn, so we had to, you know, pump up like reading recovery, for instance,
right.
research-based, you know, proven programs. So we did that, but we had to sacrifice in other areas. So I'm trying to juxtapose that, you know, against the federal level. Let's just say, okay, you know, whether we're Republicans or Democrats, let's just put that off to the side right now, and let's say we've got enough money in the system. I mean, I'm just positing that right now.
Mm-hmm.
Can we both, I mean, everybody across the political spectrum, look at what we're currently spending money on and reapportion federal dollars to things that really matter, feeding hungry kids, providing, you know, AIDS-dependent children. You know, I'm just trying to think out of the box here.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think Republicans or Democrats, you know, politically speaking, could fight with that or could argue that. Because we're not raising taxes, we're not offending anybody. We're just saying, listen, we're just really looking at our own house right now, and can we reapportion some dollars? And that's my only thought. I didn't hear the president, you know, address that tonight.
Well, and I don't think he would, Tom. And even if he does address that, it's almost an impossibility. One thing I don't think most of us understand. And Tom, thanks. Let me move on. I'll go ahead and answer this on the air. I think one thing a lot of people do not understand, the system here, the system in the United States is broken. The CEO of Starbucks, I was just quoting, said that the country is sick, which is a different way, I guess, I don't think it's sick. I think it's on its deathbed. If that's sick, okay. To try to make this system work at this point, I think is an utter impossibility. Now, I know that sounds very negative and very crappy and a terrible thing to say. And, you know, when I have to watch the President of the United States practically beg for cooperation from these zombies, the Republicans, in a program, a Jobs Act that is Republican and therefore useless. I mean, what Obama proposed, tax cuts here and tax cuts there and tax cuts all over the place. I just sat there dumbfounded. Like, you're kidding, Mr. President. You're kidding, right? Please tell me that this is not your entire speech, what you have to say. Now, again, I haven't gone over, I have it right in front of me here. I haven't gone over to, over everything, but all I'm seeing is, tax credit for veterans and, tax credits to prevent teacher layoffs. And, I don't know. Tax credits to employers for hiring long-term unemployed workers, cutting payroll taxes in half. I mean, as I'm scanning through this, that's new tax cuts to businesses to support hiring and investment. Temporarily eliminating employer payroll taxes on wages for new workers. That's all I see. And I want to tell him, you know, as if he would listen to me, Mr. President, this is ridiculous. This is ridiculous. And as weak and nothing there as it was, you still won't get any support from Republicans for a simple reason. Mr. President, they want you gone. Period.
If you're not this angry, then you're not paying attention. Back to Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Rick is in Los Angeles listening online. Hello, Rick. Hey, Rick. No, Rick's not there. We'll put him on hold and come back. Paula is in Bayonne, New Jersey. Hello, Paula.
Hey, Mike. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
Hanging in.
Good.
Hanging in. I didn't watch the speech, but I read a transcript of it.
Uh-huh.
And much of what I read really kind of bothered me a lot.
Hmm. Tell me how.
Well, first of all, the payroll tax holiday. I was against it when it passed. What was that, in December?
Uh-huh.
When they passed that? Because I don't like the idea of Social Security being linked to the general fund.
That's a good point.
And the 2% doesn't really add up to a whole lot of money for individuals.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know what I mean? Like, it's, I think I read somewhere, and I could be wrong, that for somebody making $50,000,
uh-huh,
it comes to about $1,000 a year.
Right.
So that's less than $100 a month.
Mm-hmm.
For somebody making less than that, you know, like $25,000? What does that come to? And it's dolt in, like, it's like piecemeal.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not enough money on a weekly basis to really impact anybody's life. It's not going to change anybody's spending habits or anything.
Why do you think this president is so unwilling to be a strong, grab the bull by the horns kind of style leader? When, you know, he knows, because you know, I know, Obama must know what has to be done. And what has to be done is a massive public works project similar to what Roosevelt came up with all those years ago. Why doesn't he do that?
I don't know.
Could it be that we're right, that Obama is doing what Obama is comfortable in doing, and that is assisting, even though it seems counterintuitive, but assisting in the total corporate takeover of the country, of the political system of the country? We're so close now, but I can't, every time I hear him speak, especially tonight, where he's begging Republicans to be Republicans. And he's proposing things that, by his own admission, are things that Republicans propose. Where's the Democratic leader?
I know, and why not? Like, you wanted to get Democrats elected. You don't do that by pushing Republican ideas. If they, first of all, they don't have good ideas. If they had good ideas, we'd have seen them when Bush was president.
Yeah.
And he controlled both houses of Congress. Nothing good came out of that, and nothing good is coming out of this.
You know what?
Everything and any little bit that is good is so watered down.
And I think anybody with half a brain left, or even less, we understand that tax cuts for businesses or individuals don't do anything. I mean, that has nothing to do with stimulating the economy. That doesn't create jobs. These, especially if it's a large company, they're already sitting on so much cash now. What the hell does another 2 or 3 or 4 or 5% cut in their taxes? Doesn't mean anything. It's totally meaningless.
No, it doesn't mean anything. And there aren't any strings attached with those tax cuts. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well,
they don't actually have to follow through to get them.
Well, in so many instances, you're right. There are a couple of things in here I'm looking at. Putting workers, hiring people who have been unemployed for over 6 months.
Oh, the work for free?
Huh?
The like, make the unemployed work for free part? That, I love that one, too. I say, I don't know if I like that better than the payroll tax holiday extension
or not. I know.
So now it's going to get to the point where salaries are going to be too much for labor to ask.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's what it is. This is hastening our race to the bottom.
It is. It is. I just don't get it. Paula, let me move on. Thank you. I appreciate what you had to say.
Have a good night, Mike.
Okay. Take care. Take care. I don't know. I just don't. I don't get it. You know, if we lived, maybe it's because Obama thinks we still, maybe this is it. Obama thinks we still live in a world where corporatism has not totally corrupted the system, where the capitalists don't completely own the political system, and that all Obama has to do, all he has to do is to stand there and make an appeal to Republicans to use the capitalist system to save the economy. And when I hear him speak, when I watch him now, you know, with different eyes and different ears, now when I watch him and listen to him, I think, but Mr. President, the world in which you've constructed your putting America back to work stuff, or whatever it's called, the American Jobs Act, that world doesn't exist anymore. Republicans want to see you dead politically, and maybe other ways too. Some of them, some of those old white males in there, the leaders. But the objective of Mitch McConnell and John Boehner is not to rescue this economy. Their job is to smash you into the ground. Now, if they were representatives of the people, this is my point, that wouldn't be their objective. But they're not representatives of the people. Boehner and McConnell and the rest of these sons of bitches, they're not representatives of the people. The people didn't put them there. Corporate America or capitalist America, people like the Koch brothers put them there. And the objective is to eliminate Obama, because Obama, even though he governs, you know, center right and more like right center rather than center right. And he governs like a Republican, or attempts to govern. He's been stopped at every turn pretty much. The fact that he, first of all, the fact that he is young, the fact that he is new, the fact that he is an African-American, and the fact that he's a Democrat. I mean, when you, although the Democrat thing doesn't play too much into it, when you look at the personal attacks on this man, now granted, Bush got a lot of personal attacks, but they were based on reality. Bush was a drunk. Bush was a, is a war criminal. Bush did lie, cheat, sneak, and steal. I mean, everything that was leveled against Bush was true. Barack Obama was not born in Malaysia or Singapore. Barack Obama is not a Muslim. You know, Barack Obama has a birth certificate. You understand? So the objective is to destroy him. Destroy him. And to take down with Barack Obama what these corporatists think is the last best hope in terms of resistance. Well, newsflash, Barack Obama's not the last best hope. And the capitalists are in for a bloody, prolonged fight. They really are. I mean, I just don't believe that 300 million Americans are just going to give up the ghost and say, okay, we're all set now to become serfs and slaves and watch everything privatized and our electoral system become like the Soviet Union's. Here are your candidates. Go vote. And amazingly, the machines spit out the winners, the proper winners, just about every time. And I don't think, I've said this for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. I don't know what the tipping point is. I really don't. But it's there. It has to be there. We are not totally unconscious in this country, even though it seems like it sometimes. But there are enough of us who are not totally unconscious. I'm talking about tens of millions of people who are not totally unconscious. So, Lewis is in Cocoa Beach or Cocoa, Florida?
Cocoa, Florida.
Hey, Lewis.
Hi, how are you? Listen, I have been an activist and involved in politics for a long, long time, and I was a heavy-duty supporter of Obama, and listening to him and listening to, I agree with a lot of what you have to say, but if Obama thinks that he is going to get anywhere in the realm of being reelected, mm-hmm. he has to do something for the base, for the liberals. And the liberals, it is time for people to understand that what the liberals are fighting for, what we are fighting for, is something that is good for the country. Every time that America, every time that Obama decides to dump on the liberals, dump on his base, he's basically telling people that he is ashamed of the Democratic Party ideals.
Well, he is. Lois, let me put you on hold a second, because I've got to take a break here. But I don't think Obama sees liberals as his base. He and Rahm Emanuel, his former chief of staff, made it very clear that liberals were a pain in the ass and useless and whiners. And I don't think he sees liberals as his base at all.
It's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. All right, Lewis, I got another minute here for you. Go ahead.
Okay, and also, I guess what I'm trying to say, final question, final thing for you is, and I mean, what do we do now? I mean, that's all of the activists and all the people who are mm-hmm. out there in the field. If Obama can't go back and forth saying, like tonight, that millionaires should pay their fair share, and if they were to do that, why didn't he stand up against the Bush tax cuts during the lame duck session in December?
Right,
he's leaving his troops out here in the field, and what are we to do?
Well, it's a good question, Lewis. And for the time being, I think it's going to have to remain a rhetorical question because the liberal left, the progressive left, is very disorganized right now. There are attempts being made to reorganize the liberal left to start offering up resistance because Barack Obama is not an ally of the liberal left. In a more innocent time and place, whenever and wherever that was, he would have made a great Republican president, if that's not a contradiction in terms. But that was then or some other time, and it's not now. Lewis, thanks. I appreciate what you had to say. From Prairie 2, President Obama has proposed a laundry list of Republicans' previous proposals for job creation. He is, of course, counting on the Republicans not passing this into law, as it would be a dismal failure if enacted. Only 100 of the $400 billion proposal is actual infrastructure work that would provide stimulus to the economy. And this is 1/30th of the amount needed just to revitalize America without doing any expansion or modernization along the lines of what China's doing. Obama made reference to China in an effort to shame the Republicans into doing something, but this proposal is so anemic that Obama should himself be ashamed to compare it favorably to what China is doing. The bulk of the proposal is payroll tax cuts, but some of that is already in effect, and it's not new stimulus, but rather just a defensive move to keep things from getting worse. Eric Cantor jumped right in, proclaiming that the Republicans could peel off certain proposals and pass them, like the 50% payroll tax cut for employers. This is the one aspect of Obama's proposal that would do zero stimulus. So, of course, the Republicans can get behind that. Obama did take the occasion to announce his intention to go ahead with mortgage refinancing at the current 4% rate, which would save the average family $2,000 a year. Obama pointed out that Republicans should be in favor of that sort of thing. He didn't get any applause. In fact, they will oppose it vehemently. It will cost their real constituents, the rich, billions. He made a point of saying he doesn't need congressional support to do this, and this elicited more silence. Obama also alluded to other unnamed things he intends to do without congressional approval. The one really big thing he could do is a Michelle Bachmann on gas prices. It's within the president's power to drive down commodity prices by restricting who can trade in the futures market and by increasing the margin requirement to 50%. Rules to do this under the Dodd-Frank law were to take effect early this year and are now tentatively scheduled for the end of the year if there aren't more delays. The president's speech was political, or you could say it was educational, in the sense that it, again, points out that Republicans are traitors. Obama also passed the buck to them on paying for the proposal by finding still more budget cuts, something Republicans really don't want to do, as real voters would find themselves on the receiving end of such cuts. He also suggested that they might raise Warren Buffett's taxes to the level of his secretary's. And then, if you listen closely, you could hear gasps of horror. In short, the things within Obama's power to do, mortgage refinancing and energy price cuts, would have far more effect on the economy than the Republican mishmash he proposed in the speech. The only thing is that the economy will still be in the tank a year from now. And Obama has to convince voters that he's really doing something while the Republicans aren't. Lucky for Obama, the Republicans can't figure out how not to play along as they are fully committed to their treachery. PrairieNumeral2.com, that is Bruce's assessment on what we heard tonight. It's a real shame. I swear to God, I sat here and almost, I didn't, but I almost felt that feeling of choking up and wanting to cry. Listening to what now passes for an attempt to be bipartisan, even though the bipartisanship is an illusion. It's all Republican stuff. Everything that Obama said was Republican. But to listen to a president beg and plead while the country has reached full stop. I mean, we're dead in the water. And that can't, I mean, how long can we hold on? I mean, seriously, how long can this country, this society, our people, how long can we sustain ourselves? How long? I don't know. I have no idea. Do you? I mean, there's 1% of the population that will sustain itself no matter what. Unless, of course, there's a bloody revolution and they're all taken out and hanged, then they can't sustain themselves. But I don't think that will happen in this country either. I think that what is required is what I'm going to talk about with my guest next hour, Dr. Margaret Flowers. So I'm going to invite you to stick around. We'll be back momentarily. It is 7 past the hour. This is the Molloy Program. In a second, we're going to be joined by Dr. Margaret Flowers. I want to share something with you here that she posted a couple of months ago. It's an open letter about the October 2011 movement. And I'm just going to read a couple of sentences for you. This is what Margaret posted. Inspired by the courageous nonviolent uprisings in Tunisia, Egypt, Bahrain, Yemen, Greece, Spain, and elsewhere, people in the United States have come together to form the October 2011 movement. This fusion of peace, social justice, environmental, student, and immigrant rights organizations is in solidarity with all who seek a peaceful, just, and sustainable future and stands ready to engage in its own campaign of nonviolent resistance, beginning in Washington, D.C. this October. We recognize that your revolution is our revolution, that American empire prevents you from achieving self-determination and economic justice, and that only together can we achieve our shared goals. October marks the beginning of the 11th year of the U.S. invasion and destruction of Afghanistan. It marks the beginning of yet another federal budget that delivers unlimited funds for war and corporate interests while putting in place an austerity budget for services that meet human and environmental needs. But this October will mark the beginning of something else in the United States, a movement, when we will unite to demand an end to a system that puts profits in warfare over the welfare of people and the environment. Now, Margaret posted this, and it was written by the October 2011 organization, .org movement, which is a coalition of individuals and organizations. But I have a feeling that Margaret wrote it. Now, one more thing. Under the authorship of Kevin Zeese, who will be on next week, Margaret Flowers, Tarak Kauf, and Elaine Brower. And this is the one I want you to listen to. There comes a time when efforts to avoid the truth begin to fail. When one can no longer go about daily life and pretend that all is okay. If you're like most of us, you're experiencing this. There comes a time when one can no longer shut out the atrocities of U.S. foreign policy and military policy, trade agreements that destroy farming, mass unemployment, especially among communities of color, illegal detention and torture, increasing drone attacks resulting in mass civilian deaths, and once again a president who lies the United States into another war for oil and bankers. The time comes when one can no longer close one's eyes to the atrocities of U.S. domestic policy that steals from the people to add to the already hideously bursting pockets of the wealthy, that kicks people out of their homes, that denies needed medical treatment and drives families into bankruptcy so that CEOs can dine on gold-plated or gold-lined plates in their personal jets as they travel from gated mansion to leather seats in penthouse offices. A time comes when one cannot help but realize that the path is unsustainable and one must make a choice. History is knocking, and each of us must choose how we will answer. What do you want to say? What do you want to say you did when history was at your door? And it goes on. You can find these, I'm sure, at October2011.org. Joining us now from Baltimore is Dr. Margaret Flowers. Margaret, thanks for taking some time out to chat tonight.
Oh, thank you for inviting me on, Mike. It's a real honor.
Did you, by chance, let me kind of back into this conversation, because I do want to, and I know a lot of people listening to this program want to find out more about this movement. Did you, by chance, listen to or watch or both Obama's speech tonight?
I heard a little bit about it, but I was not able to watch it. I had something going on.
Uh-huh. I watched it in its entirety, and I have to say, and we've been talking about this on the program for this first hour, or the first hour just passed, that it was a Republican, or I wouldn't even say Republican, it was a corporatist or capitalist way, center, not even center-right anymore, right-wing approach to solving a problem that is systemic right now, that is just not solvable using the system that we currently have in place. And I don't know why that is not obvious to more than a few people in this country, that the system has become so corrupt that it is not, in my opinion, it is not fixable. It has to be replaced. Would you say that's a fair statement?
Oh, I think you're absolutely on target. And I think more and more people are starting to realize that, but they're up against a very well-financed and very talented propaganda machine that creates divisions among the population by dividing us into Republicans and Democrats and having that, you know, battle against each other. But I think more and more people are realizing that, that really those are both corporate parties and the political process is broken.
How do you think we got to this point? I believe a lot of the corruption has come because of the way the electoral system has been corrupted. But how do you think we got to this point?
Well, this has been, you know, the history of this country for a very long time. I mean, the Constitution was written by, you know, white, wealthy, propertied men to benefit them. And unfortunately, it actually undercut kind of a real organic, sustainable economic system that was developing as the, you know, U.S. tried to pull away from the British Empire. So I think it's been a long time. Even, you know, President Lincoln warned about corporations and the banks. He said he feared them more than war.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we know during FDR's time that really the banksters were, you know, in control at that point as well. And only concessions were made because there was such a strong uprising from the people to pressure that. So I think it's been a long time part of U.S. history, and definitely we're seeing the kind of downfall of what happens as a country, you know, mm-hmm. uses that system, what the results of that are.
Do you think there is an attitude, I won't say prevailing attitude, but an attitude in this country of learned helplessness? Because I've been talking now and have been part of a conversation, I should say, about... or the question being, at what point, where's the tipping point? At what point do the American people, like the Tunisians, like the Egyptians, like the Greeks, like the French, at what point do the American people say, this is enough? Or has it gotten to the point where learned helplessness is kind of stopping that kind of reaction?
I think that we're, you know, you're absolutely right that this country... You know, we've been so educated in a way to be compliant, to be to not question authority, and really, like I said, the propaganda machine has been going, you know, since the early 1900s. And so I do think that more and more people are starting to get it and to wake up. If you look at, you know, nations and what conditions arise or, you know, lead to revolution, we're really there in terms of the wealth inequality, the mm-hmm. unemployment, all of these indicators. And what we found when we were starting to put this movement together is that as we reached out to other people and other organizations, so many of them were coming to the same conclusion around the same time. So it really does feel like the time is ripe. And there is a lot going on around the country that people are not aware of, people fighting back. Because it doesn't get covered in the regular corporate media.
Margaret, if you don't mind, can I put you on hold? We have to take a break here, and we'll come back and chat some more if you can stick around, okay?
Yes, please.
Okay. Our guest is Dr. Margaret Flowers, who is one of the organizers of the October2011.org movement. And I've been mentioning that for a couple of months now, actually, I think. Go to the website. And you'll find some information there. We'll continue the discussion in just a moment. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
The voice inside your head. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. We're talking with Dr. Margaret Flowers. She is a medical doctor. Her specialty is pediatric medicine. She's also one of the organizers of the October2011.org movement. The website for that you can go to anytime. When you mentioned, Margaret, about... the activities that are going on in this country, there are efforts being made to organize, efforts being made to resist what is happening and how it doesn't get any media coverage. You know, we've talked on this program many times. It wasn't doctors, it wasn't plumbers, it wasn't car mechanics who were offered or any kind of mechanic, I should say, that were offered constitutional protection. It was the press. And the press has failed just in incredibly from the original intent was. Now, I grant you, the press is not what it was back in Ben Franklin's day, but still, I'm sure you have attended events, I know I have, where you'll have 250,000 people, and if it gets coverage at all, it's scant, it's usually reported on in kind of a condescending way. The event planned in D.C., in October, mm-hmm. what if it suffers the same kind of lack of coverage?
You know, that's an interesting question because we decided early on that we weren't even going to go after corporate media coverage. that we feel very strongly that there are kind of three principles that we need to follow, and one is being independent. And for that, for us, that means building an independent movement and creating an independent media, or, you know, strengthening the one that we have growing in this country. And then ultimately, when the system starts to weaken, we'll be able to have an independent political movement. So if you go to our website, you'll see that we have lots of media that's covering this event, but mm-hmm. they're all independent media. We're also encouraging people to be the media themselves, and we'll be doing a webinar on that next week to teach people those skills.
Why is it, in your opinion, that what is left of so-called liberal media in this country, and by that I'm referring to talk television or talk radio and certain online liberal or left-leaning commentators or programs, but they too seem to, especially the ones on radio and television, seem to have failed where it concerns, I'm not saying everybody, but where it concerns right. letting people know that there is resistance starting to arise in this country and it should be supported. What has happened to the so-called liberal media, those little pieces of it that remain?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think Chris Hedges puts it so well in his book called Death of the Liberal Class
mm-hmm.
and what has happened to so many of our liberal institutions. But yeah, I was just out in Wisconsin, and I spoke on a panel with John Nichols from The Nation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I spoke right before him and went out, you know, talked about the fact that our political process is broken and it doesn't matter who we elect into it right now. And he got right up and started talking about how we need to elect more Democrats, which I thought was really interesting. Yeah, it's disappointing. I mean,
that's the part that is very disappointing. It's also very frustrating. Yeah. I've been a Nation subscriber for decades, and yet there are so many people, with the obvious exception of Alexander Coburn, but there are so many people that write for the Nation who are still trying to either shore up the Democratic Party or
right.
Convince the readership that the Democratic Party, within the Democratic Party, there is, I hate to use this word, but there's salvation. And I just don't see it. And I was brought up as a coalition Democrat. I grew up in Toledo, Ohio, for God's sake. I mean, everything that occurred in that city was union based. So the Democratic Party now, the leadership anyway, the top echelon, if you will, of the Democratic Party is not that any longer. And I don't understand why respectable magazines of the left, like The Nation, occasionally even Mother Jones, still pretends that the system is savable.
I think it also, you know, it really has a lot to do with the money and the funders. And, you know, the liberal funders are still very much tied to the Democratic Party. That whole economic elite class is very cohesive, and they fund a lot of these, you know, progressive so-called institutions. And, you know, we know, we have evidence, there actually was a good article in The Nation about Jim Messina and how he used to meet with the heads of progressive organizations in D.C. and tell them what they could say and threaten them with losing mm-hmm. their funders if they didn't do what the White House, you know, wanted them to do.
Mm. Can you,
pretty heavy-handed stuff.
Can you, I have to take another break. Can you stick around?
Yes.
Okay, when we come back, I want to move on now to the October 2011 movement and talk about that a bit, okay?
Great, thank you.
Our guest is Dr. Margaret Flowers. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour, we're talking to Dr. Margaret Flowers, who is a physician, pediatric medicine. She's also one of the organizers of the October2011.org movement. Now that we've kind of established, Margaret, how miserable everything is, although I don't think a conversation between you and me is going to establish that any more than, you know, just people opening their eyes.
Right.
But tell us, if you would, about October 2011 movement, how it got started, and what the immediate goal is.
Thank you. Yeah, well, you know, as bad as things are for me, I'm still actually very hopeful and optimistic, because the truth is that we, the people in this country, have the numbers to turn this around.
Mm-hmm.
We also have majority support for so many of these issues, for solutions that would point us in the right direction. So things like, you know, national Medicare for all, green jobs, taxing the wealthy, bringing the troops home, all these things we need to do have supermajority support. So my coming to this movement really was from my experience in trying to push for a national health insurance program, a single-payer program,
mm-hmm.
and my experiences in Congress doing that. And after the reform passed, and it was so disappointing, because it was really written for the industries that are profiting off of our current situation, I was traveling around and people said, how do we get single payer? And it became more and more obvious that what we need to do is see healthcare as part of the broader picture.
Mm-hmm.
Because even if we got healthcare, access to medical treatment to every person in this country, that's only about 10% of our health. And the other 90% has to do with education and housing and a job with a living wage and food and a clean environment and all these other factors. They're really tied together. So the other thing that I learned out of that experience was that the normal tools of democracy that we use don't work. And what really pushed the single-payer movement forward some were actions of civil disobedience. So I think that's got to be a key part of how we shift the power from this corporate control of the political process to the people. So I did an action with the Veterans for Peace in December because I wanted to show how the movements could come together in solidarity and see the connections between their issues.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, the conversations continued, and a number of us really wanted to try to push forward with this. And so as we reached out to others and other movements and other people that we knew around the country, so many were feeling the same way. So we decided just to, you know, see what we could do. And we've been working pretty nonstop since about March or April of this year on this, and it's coming together really nicely. This is all done by volunteer effort, but every day new people join us and want to volunteer, and it's just tremendous.
The movement then, and I think people should know that the movement that you're talking about is very broad spectrum, because all of these issues tie together, and all of these issues have been derailed or turned aside by corporate interests. And that since it is a broad spectrum movement, that therefore people from across the spectrum of society, whether people are working right now or not working, whether they're students or retirees, men, women, black, white, Jew, Gentile, gay, straight, this affects everybody. So everybody should at least show an interest in the October2011.org movement. How do you get people to show that interest that is so critical? Do you just present yourself and wait for people to come, or what do you do?
Right. Well, and you're absolutely right. This is a broad-based people's movement. It's about evidence-based solutions for all the crises that we're facing. We all face the same obstacle. We started out by doing a lot of research to organizations and to individuals who had some name recognition, and reaching out to our independent media contacts and just trying to get the word out that way. And as we slowly starting to get the word out. More and more organizations contacted us wanting to be part of this. More and more individuals contacted us wanting to volunteer. So now we have, I guess it was about 3 weeks ago, I was getting so overwhelmed with emails that I said, I really need people all around the country that can answer these questions. I'm getting the same questions. And within 3 weeks, I now have, I think, 30 states have one or more organizers that just contacted me and volunteered when they heard that that's what we needed. So mm-hmm. It's been really amazing that way, how people just step up.
It goes back to Saul Alinsky and to Mario Savio. Alinsky, of course, being the one who said organize, 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 and Mario Savio being the one who said there comes a time when you have to stop the machine. And you know that speech on the steps at Berkeley Hall, is astonishing to me because it was in 1964. I mean, back when there was still at least a modicum of or resemblance to democratic government in this country, at least on the surface. Now, I understand that there were all sorts of terrible things going on that this is before WikiLeaks. This is before Bradley Manning. This is before Julian Assange. This is before people started to understand. Which brings me to the Bradley Manning thing. I was in D.C. With the Veterans for Peace in March, I believe, with the action in front of the White House, and then the next day after we all got out of jail, going down to Quantico, Virginia, with the protests there. And it was shortly after that Manning was moved to Fort Leavenworth, I believe, where he was given a little bit, as my understanding, at least I haven't heard otherwise from his attorney, a little bit more appropriate treatment for someone who is being detained the way he is. Not that the detention is appropriate, because I don't think a Manning deserves what's going on right now. But the truth of what has come out and continues to come out through WikiLeaks is just astonishing. And I realize several global newspapers around the globe have taken upon themselves to go ahead and publish some of this stuff. But I'm just wondering why people don't read this and say, you know, oh my God, this is, because there's nothing in there that's top secret. It just shows the deviousness and the treachery that goes on 24/7. With the U.S. State Department. It's astonishing. And not just ours. I mean, other State Departments too, or other departments of state, whatever they're called, foreign ministries, whatever. So it's that issue that seems to me those revelations that should motivate people to say, what the hell is going on here? And start to really, truly, honestly, actually resist.
Yeah. I think, you know, as more and more people hopefully will turn off their TVs. I think there's a lot in our culture that really distracts people and miseducates them. I run into people that are fairly intelligent who still believe that all of this increasing kind of militarization of our country, increasing encroachment on our civil liberties, makes them feel better. Makes them feel safer. And that's mind-boggling to me. But that's the propaganda that's out there. But I mean, I guess for me, it just takes a core group of people to stand up and start speaking the truth that I think most people deep inside believe. And as I think that we do that and more people join us, I'm hoping, you know, that it will spread. And all we can do is try.
What do you anticipate occurring on October 6th in Washington?
Well, we're going to be going that morning to Freedom Plaza. And if all goes well and there are no, you know, last minute emergencies that cause the D.C. police to have to close the plaza down, we are planning to set up there and have a rally in the afternoon with music and speakers, primarily speakers who are people with powerful stories. And we're going to stay in that plaza from that point forward, if we can. We set up a camp there. We have materials to do a medical tent, a food tent,
an arts area. There'll be an arts exhibit. We'll have kind of a legal civil resistance tent where we can organize actions of civil resistance. We do have an action plan for the first day in the afternoon that I think is going to be very creative and really kind of set the tone. And we're going to have two kind of things going on in that plaza. We're going to stop the machine with daily actions of resistance. And then the Create a New World part is that we've identified 15 issues on the website that have evidence-based solutions that would address them, and we'll be dividing into 15 committees to work on specific demands related to each of those crises. And at, in the evening assembly, which we hope will be live streamed nationally so people can join in, we'll go over these issues and these solutions. And hopefully by the end we'll have a document similar to what they did in Spain with some very concrete changes that we want to see made. And
Margaret, can you hold on one more time?
Sure.
Can you hold just one more time? I got to take a quick break. We'll come back. We're talking to Dr. Margaret Flowers. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. It's about 10 before the hour. We've been talking this hour with Dr. Margaret Flowers, physician who is was active and continues to be active in the single-payer health care idea in this country, and also part of the organizers of the October2011.org movement. The website is available, October2011.org. Margaret, we're talking just briefly, I want to digress here a bit. We're talking about the failure of media. Here's one for you. A listener just sent this to me from the Seattle Times from yesterday. There's a strike that has gone violent out there, a labor dispute between longshoremen and the Port of Longview. And there's some pictures that are up from Wednesday. And then today, the workers at a standstill, it says, at some northwest seaports, including Seattle. At least 500 longshoremen stormed the Port of Longview about 4:30 a.m. and broke out windows of the guard shack, according to Longview Police Chief. Longshoremen wielding baseball bats and crowbars held six guards hostage. Others cut brake lines on boxcars and dumped grain. 50 officers from surrounding areas responded to the scene. No one was injured. There were no arrests. A spokesman for the International Longshoremen Warehouse Union said the incident started Wednesday afternoon when police pepper sprayed, struck longshoremen at the clubs, and manhandled ILWU President Robert McElrath after the union president blocked a train on its way to the terminal. Police arrested 19 longshoremen. The person that sent this to me said, "Looks as if some people's patience is wearing thin." Though personally, I would have much rather seen the dock workers show up on the doorstep of the dock company's CEO. Is there any one particular, would this be a precipitating incident? Again, I'm looking for that one incident that's going to cause the American people to wake up and realize what has happened here.
Yeah, I think, as far as the longshoremen go, they have been doing some pretty radical nonviolent actions during this year. Those same dock workers, I think 100 of them were arrested this summer trying to stop the grain trains because the port decided to go with non-union workers to unload those trains. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry to hear that they're actually having to get into violence. But I think that there was a kind of a wake-up call this year with the actions in Madison, and then we really saw that all around the country and in capitals and many other states as well. So I think people are starting to wake up. And
do you think there's a chance that Freedom Plaza in D.C. could become a U.S. equivalent of a Tahrir Square in Egypt?
Yeah, that's our hope. But in Egypt and other, well, in Egypt they had many protests prior to the one that was actually the big one. Mm-hmm. So this may be the big one if the time is right, and if not, we're going to keep organizing until we get to that point.
If people cannot make it to this event, and I realize October 6th is just the beginning, but if folks can't make it, how can they support this movement? A lot of folks who just simply can't be there, although they would like to. So, and a lot of people can't make financial contributions. So how do people support this in a way that makes them feel like they're part of a movement that may be being born?
Well, the beauty of this is that people can participate in whatever way they're able to. And so if they can't come to Freedom Plaza, they can still join our online community on the website and join the discussions that are going on there to have their voice heard. If we're able to get the live streaming in the plaza, then we'll live stream the assemblies every night, and we're hoping there'll be ways that people can give feedback on the issues that we're talking about in the plaza. People are organizing solidarity actions starting on October 15th around the country, because that's going to be a global day of action, so people can attend actions locally or organize one. And then we're going to be talking a lot about solutions that people can implement, or methods of non-cooperation. Mm-hmm. If you remember when Gandhi was speaking to the British and they said, do you expect us to just leave your country? And he said, yes. And they said, are you going to make us do that? And he basically said, when, you know, millions of Indians are not cooperating with your system, you'll see the wisdom of leaving. And so there are many methods mm-hmm. of non-cooperation that people can engage in, just simply from buying local and supporting, you know, their community, independent businesses, you know, voting with your dollar, so to say.
Yeah, that's in this sort of system that is very effective, although it would have been much better, I think, if people would have voted with their dollars about 2 years ago when some of us still had some. But,
right.
Marga, it's been very enlightening to talk to you, and I hope to see you at some point in, although we have met, in the Veterans for Peace rally. I think you were at the second one. Matter of fact, I think we both spoke at the second one. But I hope to see you in D.C., and I appreciate what you and Kevin and Tarak and so many people who are organizing this, what you are doing. And perhaps we can talk again, okay?
Thank you very much. Really appreciate your support, and I look forward to seeing you in D.C. again.
Okay, Margaret. Take care.
Okay.
Have a nice
care.
Evening. Dr. Margaret Flowers, and you can go to the website, October2011.org. Check it out. We'll be back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. It is 7 past the hour. Had enough yet? Ooh. On the eve of revolution? Nah. This is almost impossible to believe when you first see it. And then after you read into it a little bit, you go, yeah, that's true. At TVNewsLies.org this morning when I got their email that has headlines, articles, and stuff, you ought to sign up for that. TVNewsLies.org. And you get this thing in the email. You know, New York Times will send you a summary. TVNewsLies.org will send you, you know, it's pretty cool. Anyway, I got this at their website this morning, TVNewsLies.org. The Department of Homeland Security and local law enforcement in Phoenix, Arizona, have misplaced their own bomb used in a live drill at Sky Harbor Airport. They've lost a bomb. For the past few days, the Department of Homeland Security and other officials have been hunting for live explosives that have gone missing from a drill conducted late last week. Let that sink in a second. I mean, for Christ's sake, they have a drill, they use live bombs, and they lose them in an airport? The fact that the agency is supposed to protect Americans from terror, right, and is now possibly aiding terrorists by losing track of deadly explosive compounds that could be used or blamed in future events to further control the population of the United States with fear, terror, and loathing, right? Isn't that how all this works? The national security state? What did Goebbels or Himmler or somebody say about, you know, I'll tell you how to control your population. Create an external enemy and then keep telling your population that enemy is coming to get you. Oh, my God. Anyway, losing live bombs, things that explode shows how corrupt and inept these government officials have become, especially the Department of Homeland Security, the baby that was born kicking and screaming out of Dick Cheney's loins. Isn't it amazing how quickly after the attacks of September 11, 2001, the Department of Homeland Security was born? I mean, page after page, documents that's hundreds and hundreds of pages long, and all of a sudden it just materialized. My goodness, it was like, well, I don't know, like the virgin birth of Christ. One moment, there is no Department of Homeland Security. The next, whoosh, there is. Now, how could that be? How could that be? Have you ever gone to their website? Have you ever looked at the rules and regs, the authorization for the creation of the Department of Homeland Security? If you look at it and you say to yourself, well, how did they pull this together in 2 weeks? unless it was drawn up ahead of time. Ooh, Mike, you're getting all 911 conspiratorial again. Ooh, Mike, now, back off. Don't go crazy. Uh-huh. And the comment about this story, TV News Lies from .org, when they have one of these weird stories like this, they usually add a little editorial comment before they direct you to the jump where you can pick up the whole article. And their comment here is, live drills can turn into false flag attacks in a second. Who planted the live bomb in the Phoenix airport for the drill? That person can be cut loose and turned into a patsy. That is the most likely role the so-called 9/11 hijackers played. Oh, you see, Jesse Richard at TVNewsLies.org, the founder of that site, Like most of us who still have any mind left, do not accept the official story of the events of that day. We just don't. We cannot. It's like trying to accept the idea that the sun revolves around the earth. I read something the other day, I think it was in Harper's Index, that 3 out of 5 Russians do believe that. 3 out of 5 Russians believe that the earth, or the sun, revolves around the earth. That's probably the influence of the almighty Orthodox Christian Church that came screaming out of the bowels of hell once communism fell. We're back! Rah! Well, religion will do that to you. So anyway, they lost weapons, explosives at the Phoenix airport. Department of Homeland Destruction. They've lost it. Well, we don't know where it is. The debate last night, not the debate, the whatever the hell that was with those 8 Republican clowns. With the exception possibly of Huntsman, I mean, I've never seen such a collection of cheats, liars, sneaks, morons, idiots, religious fanatics, crazy people posturing as candidates for the presidency. Well, sure, this is what you get. This is what you get. I hope you took a long look at that lineup, you know, that abbreviated version of the June Taylor dancers. There they were. I hope you took a look at them. This is what you get when your company, when your country becomes a company and is run by corporatists, run by predatory capitalists who laugh at the whole damn process. This is what they give you. Michelle Bachmann, Newt Gingrich. Oh, my God. Well, Ron Paul's just in there for a little bit of spice. Limbaugh, the pig man, the man who gives new definition to the horrific, stinky term pig feces, Limbaugh has a prediction after watching this last night. Marco Rubio will be president. Marco Rubio. Now, he is a senator from Florida, right? He came out of nowhere. He is, he's a senator. I mean, I don't know that much about Rubio. I do know a couple of essential facts, though. Rubio was born in Florida, but his parents were born in Cuba. Rubio was born in Florida in 1971. His parents didn't become citizens until 1975. So therefore, you've got to question, what does the Constitution mean by the phrase that in order to run for president or be president, you have to be a natural-born citizen? Natural-born citizen. Now, the Constitution doesn't define the phrase, but there is general agreement that the term means, at a minimum, anyone born on U.S. soil to U.S. citizen parents. Whoops. You know, so Limbaugh, you know, this piece of pig feces, you know, he's talking about Marco Rubio is going to be president. He's predicting he's going to be president. He's going to be president. Well, Mr. Pigman, just one problem with that has to do with how one defines, you know, the Constitution, Pigman. You know, that goddamn piece of paper, as Bush called it. What do you call it, Pigman?
Still loving me, joker's to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with
Redefining Anger Management. Back to Mike Malloy.
The hour, and then there's this. Where did this happen? Oh yeah, on Tuesday, the war criminal and mass murderer, not to mention sociopath Donald Rumsfeld, former defense secretary, former death secretary. He was on Greta Van Susteren's program, apparently, on the Rupert Murdoch Terrorist Broadcast Television Organization's telecast. And Rumsfeld told Greta Van Susteren that Barack Obama has come to accept much of the Bush doctrine out of necessity, in spite of what he campaigned on in 2008, right? Rumsfeld said Obama needed to keep Guantanamo Bay Detention Center open because of national security concerns. Mm-hmm. And according to Rumsfeld, that was the best solution among a whole host of bad options. He said, quote, "They ended up keeping Guantanamo open not because they like it. We didn't like it either, but they couldn't think of a better solution," end quote. Really? You didn't like it? Oh, come on, Rumsfeld. That was like sex for you and Cheney. You know it was. And you know what they say about sex? Even bad sex is good sex, right? Torture videos, ordering people to have bad things done to their physical and mental bodies and minds and conditions. Come on, Rummy. That was catnip for you, you slimy war criminal. Rumsfeld then went on with Greta Van Susteren and listed a whole handful of other Bush administration policies that have continued into the Obama administration, something that he sees as vindication, of course. Of course, if the Obama administration won't prosecute anybody, and like we mentioned last night, and I'm going to bring it up again here in a second, there's a reason, according to the dean of the law school at UC Berkeley, there's a reason why Obama decided not to pursue prosecution of the worst war criminals, by definition, that there are. That's whose definition? The definition put down by the United States at the Nuremberg war crimes trials. And Bush and Cheney and everyone associated with his crime organization fall into that category of having committed the worst possible crimes against humanity by definition. But anyway, Rumsfeld says that all of those policies, those war crimes now, have been vindicated. They all have gotten the stamp of approval from the Obama administration. This is something we've been talking about in this program for how long now? But the liberals in talk radio or the progressives on talk television will, of course, avoid talking about this. As Politico.com quotes Rumsfeld this way, quote, in his discussion with Greta Van Susteren, "The same is true with the Patriot Act and military commissions and indefinite detention. All of those things were criticized, but today are still in place 2.5 years later because they are the best alternative to the other choices. And they are, in fact, successful in keeping America safer," end quote. I see. Those who give up liberty for the illusion of security, I'm modifying, wind up with neither. Now, back during the campaign, of course, leading up to the election of the corporatist Barack, President Barack Obama, Obama campaigned against so many aspects of the Bush crime family's so-called war on terror, remember? But in spite of that, when you take a look at Obama's national security policy, it is identical to that of George W. Bush. How do liberals explain this? How do media liberals and progressives explain this? How do they sit there on their talk television and talk radio programs with that very concerned look on their faces or that tone in their voices and defend, continue to defend the policies of Barack Obama when they are identical to the policies of George W. Bush? How do you do that? Well, you don't, unless you are a full-blown, absolute, complete, and total either hypocrite or deceiver. Which is it? You cannot be but one or the other if you are defending Obama policies and condemning Bush policies when they are one and the same.
Strikes for higher wage, planet lurches to the right as ideologies engage. Suddenly it's repression, moratorium on rights. What did they think the politics of panic would invite? Person on the street shrugs, security comes first. But double the normal is it all it gets worse.
Seekers, Uncle Mikey has another bedtime story. Back to Mike Malloy.
Twenty-five before the hour, Tom Englehart, who has TomDispatch.com website, another great website, TomDispatch.com. Has an excellent idea posted at his website, and it's one that bears some serious thought. He is suggesting that we cancel all the commemoration of 9/11. And this is what he writes. Let's bag it. I'm talking about the 10th anniversary ceremonies for 9/11 and everything that goes with them. The solemn reading of the names of the dead, the tolling of bells, the honoring of first responders, the gathering of presidents, the dedication of the new memorial, the moments of silence, the works. Let's just can it all. Shut down Ground Zero. Lock out the tourists. Close Reflecting Absence, the memorial built in the so-called footprint of the former towers, with this grove of trees, giant pools, and multiple waterfalls, close it before it can be unveiled this Sunday. Discontinue work on the underground National September 11 Museum due to open in 2012. Tear down the Freedom Tower, redubbed number one World Trade Center after our freedom wars went slightly awry. It is 102 stories of, quote, the most expensive skyscraper ever constructed in the United States, end quote, the estimated price tag, $3.3 billion. Eliminate that still being constructed, hubris-filled 1,776, get it, feet of building, planned in the heyday of George W. Bush and soaring into the Manhattan sky with the nya-nya-nya-nya-nya invitation to future terrorists. Dismantle the other three office towers being built there as part of an $11 billion government-sponsored construction program. Let's get rid of it all. If we had wanted a memorial to 9/11, it would have been more appropriate to leave one of the giant shards of broken tower there untouched. Ask yourself this. 10 years into the post-9/11 era, haven't we had enough of ourselves? If we have any respect for history or humanity or decency left, isn't it time to rip the Band-Aid off the wound, to remove 9/11 from our collective consciousness? No more invocations of those attacks to explain otherwise inexplicable wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and our oh-so-global war on terror. No more invocations of 9/11 to keep the Pentagon and the national security state flooded with money. No more invocations of 9/11 to justify every encroachment on liberty, every new step in the surveillance of Americans, every advance in pat-downs and wanda-downs and strip-downs that keep fear high and the homeland security state afloat. The attacks of September 11, 2001 were in every sense abusive, horrific acts. And the saddest thing is that the victims of those suicidal monstrosities have been misused here ever since under the guise of pious remembrance. This country has become dependent on the dead of 9/11, who have no way of defending themselves against how they have been used, as an all-purpose explanation for our own goodness and the horrors we visited upon others. For the many towers worth of dead in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere whose blood is on our hands. Isn't it finally time to go cold turkey? To let go of the dead? Why keep repeating our 9/11 mantra as if it were some kind of old-time religion when we've proven that we, as a nation, can't handle it, and worse yet, that we don't deserve it? We would have been better off consigning our memories of 9/11 to oblivion, forgetting it all, if only we could. We can't, of course. But we could stop the anniversary remembrances. We could stop invoking 9/11 in every imaginable way so many years later. We could stop using it to make ourselves feel like a far better country than we are. We could, in short, leave the dead in peace and take a good, hard look at ourselves, the living, in the nearest mirror. Amen. There's more to this. You can find it at tomdispatch.com. And the part that is slithery and kind of slimy in an undefinable way to me is the fact that the odds are the events of September 11, 2001 were either fully known of in advance by the Bush crime family or fully planned in advance by the Bush crime family or used by the Bush crime family as it was, as those events were, in order to establish an even tighter, more vicious national security state. And as Tom Engelhardt points out, and so many of us have pointed out over the years, the justification for every war crime that we have committed since has been based on the events of September 11, 2001. I shudder to think of the kinds of statements and political vomit that's going to be made this year on the 10th anniversary of those events. It makes me shudder to think that Republicans can still stand up in public forums and declare that they represent the party that will keep America safe, when it was on their watch that the whole event occurred. It was their people who planned it or ignored the planning done by someone else. Either way, the Bush crime family is complicit up to their traitorous eyeballs in the entire events of that day. You know it. I know it. Stop kidding yourselves. Get your ass out of denial. Stop it. It's disgusting. The way otherwise intelligent people want to write off the events of that day as somehow a gap in the national security state that the Bush crime family had nothing on any level in competence or planning to do with it. No, 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 no. If you start thinking that, Malloy, then you go down the rabbit hole. Really? What sort of rabbit hole is it that one is required to go down to accept the official story? That 19 people with box cutters came to this country and were trained in this country, and the plot was organized in Germany and then carried out, and as a result, we attacked Afghanistan. That's not a rabbit hole. The 19 people with box cutters, several of whom turned up alive later, and all those mysterious coincidences that occurred. The finding of, a ticket stub or a passport or something in the rubble of the collapsed World Trade Center towers. Finding the passport of one of the assassins, one of the terrorists, one of the murderers intact, unburned, just lying there. Ooh, look here. Wow, so many of those events occurred. The fact that Dick Cheney ordered shot down Flight 93 in Pennsylvania. But then the mythology is built. Oh, no, those are people on board that plane who tried to wrest control of the aircraft from the hijackers. It's just so, it's so utterly disgusting, isn't it? I mean, to have gone through the failure of a criminal enterprise, the Bush administration, their failure, their absolute utter failure, and their complicity in all this, to have gone through it and then be forced year upon year upon year to commemorate it as if it actually happened the way we have been told it happened.
In the loop to help them unremember. I was flying on UA-93. That shadow in the footage, it was probably me. I'm the rumor, I'm the doubt, I'm the lie. But you wouldn't stand near me if you didn't want to die.
From the moment you wake and leave the house in the morning, the terrorists or Democrats could strike without warning. So till you're back safe in bed, wear a bucket on your head. That's what I said. And to show your support for right-wing ideology, the raids on Iraq and the rape of the ecology, while the treasury's being bled, keep a bucket on your head.
10 before the hour. Joseph Stiglitz, the economist, writing at Project Syndicate, has had an op-ed piece yesterday. And he was pointing out what a lot of people have talked about, how the attacks on this country on September 11th, whoever engineered or allowed these attacks to occur, the attacks were meant to harm the United States, and they did. But the harm was greater than I think anyone could have imagined, except maybe an inner clique of people who who saw the ripple effect, the far-reaching effects. And I don't know, that's pure speculation. But let's go with the idea that the attacks, however or by whomever they were engineered, have had devastation way beyond what occurred in Lower Manhattan and in Pennsylvania and at the Pentagon. George W. Bush's response, Stiglitz writes, compromised America's basic principles, undermined this economy, and weakened our security. Think about that sentence. If a foreign agency were to be responsible for those three circumstances, compromising America's basic principles, undermining our economy, and weakening our security, what would we do to that foreign agency? We would attack it immediately. We would bomb the hell out of it. We would round up its leaders, put them on trial for crimes against humanity, and send them to prison or to the gallows. But Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and the rest of these monsters, they're on book tour. Stiglitz and his co-author in a book that they wrote, The $3 Trillion War, calculated the cost of these wars. They calculated this 3 years ago, and the conservative tally was $3 to $5 trillion. Remember what the Cheney Bush crime family said? Oh, $50 billion at the most, and it'll be paid for by what we steal from Iraq's oil reserves. Right? Remember that? $50 billion. It's now $3 to $5 trillion. My God. In addition to that, with about 50% of returning troops eligible to receive some level of disability payment, and more than 600,000 treated so far in veterans' medical facilities, Stiglitz and his co-author now estimate that future disability payments and health care costs will approach $1 trillion. This is the Bush legacy. This is the Cheney legacy. This son of a bitch, this ghoul, Cheney can get out there on his filthy little book tour and have done for him by people like whoever interviews him, what Monica did for Bill Clinton. I mean, it's disgusting, absolutely disgusting. And Barbara Wawa is the next one to get down on her knees in front of this zombie, this killer. But the social costs reflected in veteran suicides, which in recent years are over 18 suicides of military people per day. 18 per day. This is the Bush legacy. This is the Bush-Cheney crime family legacy. Here it is. Here it is. Family breakups. Divorces, berserk activities, all of that's incalculable. How do you calculate the breakup of a family? Because of what a soldier, man or woman, experienced in Cheney and Bush's wars of opportunity. How do you calculate? Well, you don't. And as Stiglitz points out, even if Bush could be forgiven for taking America and much of the rest of the world to war on false pretenses, lies, deception, even if there's some way to forgive the son of a bitch for that and for misrepresenting the cost of these wars, there is no excuse, Stiglitz points out, for how he chose to finance his wars. This was the first war in history paid for entirely on credit. Remember? Remember? And as Stiglitz points out, ironically, the wars have undermined America's and the world's security, again in ways that the perpetrators could not have imagined. Bush tried to deceive America about the war's costs, and in the process, he underfunded the troops, refusing even basic expenditures. Remember families trying to buy armor to put on the bottoms of the Humvees that their sons and daughters were being blown into pieces about? Remember that? There was no money for armored or mine-resistant vehicles needed to protect American lives or for adequate health care for returning veterans. And get this, a U.S. court, federal court, recently ruled that veterans' rights have been violated. And guess what? Listen up, all you liberal talkers. The Obama administration claims that a veteran's right to appeal to the courts should be restricted. There's your liberal. There's your progressive. There's your Bush 2 or 3, whatever the hell it is. The Obama administration says that a veteran's right to appeal when a court's ruled against them as they seek some kind of mental help, physical help, that right to appeal should be restricted thanks to Barack Obama. Jesus, God. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.